It's not like we can all dive to the bottom of the ocean or climb volcanoes or cut a body open to repair an organ. The things we know about the world often come from other people, not entirely from our own direct experiences. So we do depend on others to deliver information to us. The question at this moment in history is how much we should trust the people delivering the information, especially through social media. The Misinformation Age is the title of a book and a talk by our next guest. Kaylin O'Connor speaks tonight at 7 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University in Ashland, part of this year's campus theme, Uncertainty. Kaylin O'Connor is a mathematician and philosopher and an associate professor of logic and the philosophy of science at the University of California, Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Jeffrey.
Well, let's start with this, philosophy of science. Science journalism is easy to understand. Philosophy of science, perhaps a bit less so. What does that mean?
Yeah, so it's an area of philosophy, and there are different things philosophers of science do. So one thing is try to understand how does science work in general? So how do scientists learn new things about the world? How do theories change? How do scientists communicate with each other? And then another thing is work that's sort of like theoretical science, but with a more philosophical bent. So, for example, using some of the tools of science to understand, say, are the things we perceive really the way they look to us? So these more philosophical questions, but using science too.
Have the pathways of information changed even within the realm of science, for example? I mean, the whole rest of the world talks to itself differently now in this age of social media. I wonder if the way that scientists talk to each other and perhaps the things they say to each other have changed as well.
Yeah, so this is actually something that philosophers of science, but also computer scientists and economists are starting to study. So it seems that things like social media are influencing communication in science because a lot of scientists, in fact, connect with each other on, say, Twitter especially, but in other areas of social media. And of course, things like the internet flatten our information space. So someone in China can very easily get in touch with someone in Iran and they can start collaborating on things. So there are a couple things that are happening as a result of that. It seems that information is flowing more quickly through scientific networks. There are sort of more communications between people.
Instant peer review.
Instant peer review, but also easier collaboration. Mm-hmm. So easier for people to connect up with someone who's really physically distant but might have an important thing for them to work on together. So that's happening. And then also scientists seem to be using social media to promote or publicize their work.
Which I have noticed, come to think of it, as you mentioned, a guest earlier today talking about vaccines and microbiology. And he's right up to date on the coronavirus that is the first case showing up in the United States. So people moving fast in that realm. Let's talk about misinformation and when you turned your attention to misinformation.
Yeah, so my co-author, James Owen Weatherall, who's at UC Irvine with me, he was the one who first wanted to start working on this. So I had been doing this work using computer simulations and mathematical models to try to study the flow of information in scientific communities. So how does a new theory spread in science, for example? And after the 2016 election in the US and the Brexit vote in the UK, so these political events where online misinformation ended up being important and playing a role, or at least was out there, he thought, well, why don't we use these kinds of models you've been building to try to study misinformation more generally, including this kind of online misinformation?
What would you say is the biggest single thing that you have learned from studying misinformation?
Well,
is there a single thing?
That's a hard question. Probably just the most important takeaway from our work is this thing about social knowledge that you mentioned. So a lot of us, when we think about how we come to know or believe something, we think of ourselves as kind of individual, rational thinkers where we see evidence about something and then we do some calculations on that evidence and then we come to have a new belief. And that is something we do, but probably a more important model and aspect of the way we come to believe things has to do with our social connections. You know, a lot of us are getting most of our beliefs just directly from other people. So someone tells you something, you decide, am I going to trust this thing or not? And then it just becomes part of your knowledge. So you mentioned before things like we've never been to the deep sea. So how do I know that there are all these creatures in the deep sea? Well, other people who have been there or sent down probes tell me, and I believe them.
Right, but so we're forced to depend upon other people to convey information to us. But then sometimes what they're conveying is not the best. And of course this goes well before social media. So what was the story of lambs that grow on trees?
Yeah, so we use this as a little example to start our book off, and I love this weirdo example. So in in Europe, in the medieval times, there was this travel memoir that was passed around. It may or may not have been really a travel memoir. It could have been a fake, but it was supposedly written by this knight who said he had traveled to a bunch of places, but most importantly for our story, he had gone to India, where he claimed to have seen these plants that had pods on them, and then inside the pods were tiny lambs. And he even said he had eaten the lambs and that they were wonderful.
We're talking lambs, baby sheep.
Baby sheep inside the pods. So this travel memoir got passed around Europe, and then people started believing that this was, in fact, a real creature. And you see illustrations of it in naturalist textbooks, right alongside things like elephants and tigers, so things that the scholars of Europe had never seen but had heard from other people that they existed. And it took 400 years for this to get sorted out. So it was 400 years during which people really believed in this. And finally, a fellow kind of tramped around, you know, Asia Minor and, you know, settled it. There is no such thing as the vegetable lamb of Tartary, as they called it.
But it actually took that level of investigation for somebody to go out and prove that I went to the places these people said they could find the vegetable lamb of Tartary, and they aren't there.
Yes. And I think the really important thing to realize about this story is that, so we have this social knowledge, we can tell each other things. This is a fantastic thing to have. I mean, this is why humans can have culture, why we can have technology, why we can, you know, do the human thing. But if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have had people believing this false thing for 400 years, just passing this false belief from person to person. So I like to think of this social knowledge spread as like opening a door where good things can come through the door, but once it's open, bad things can just come through too.
So we just talked about the belief that hung on for something like 400 years about lambs that grow on trees. Let's talk about a more modern example. How much play did the story of the Pope endorsing Donald Trump, equally untrue, get?
Yeah, so this was a piece of fake news that before the 2016 election was created, and it was spread very widely. So it was one of these, it was one of the news stories that was spread on Facebook most widely right before the 2016 election. And if you look at it, it says that the Pope has to, you know, it's supposed to be a direct statement from the Pope saying that he's going to endorse Donald Trump because Hillary Clinton is frankly just so awful and we can't trust her. Yeah, it seems to have been created probably by some young guy in the Ukraine.
Were you able to trace the origin then of the story?
So this story, we didn't trace it, but people at BuzzFeed had looked at it. And it's hard to know often exactly where these originate because people will take them and kind of copy them directly to new sites. Mm-hmm. But if you look at a lot of these new sites, they often were, you know, like some 20-year-old guy who's just finding things on the internet, putting it on the site.
It was interesting to read your account of this, too, and learn that the place that it appears to have started no longer exists. Websites shut down. I mean, it seems like there's a fair amount of that places that once, you know, put themselves out there as, oh, yeah, we're a great news organization and a great news source, poof.
Yeah, well, because, I mean, they're not legitimate or real news sources, right? And so often if people aren't trusting them anymore or the person who's just running it is done for whatever reason, right, they might just shut down.
So is the who we get information from more important perhaps than what the info is?
Well, when it comes to trust, that probably is the case because for all of us, so this fact that we can't go investigate every claim ourselves. We can't go find out if tomatoes have lycopene in them. How on earth would one of us go about doing that, right? Unless you have this very specialized knowledge. So we can't do that. That means that we have to be deciding all the time when we get new pieces of information, am I going to trust it or am I not going to trust it? And maybe we have some evidence, but we're depending a lot on who the source is often. And people seem to have these heuristics that help us decide based on who's telling me something, am I going to trust it or not? And we have heuristics like, has this person lied to me before or have they generally been trustworthy? So that's a pretty good heuristic. But also things like, is this person of my same race and gender? Are they on the soccer team with me? Do they have an attractive personality? We also use those things to decide, are we going to trust or not?
So a number of sets of connections that will tell us, you know, as the list gets longer, this person is somebody I can trust.
Yeah. So, I mean, often we make that decision based on, do I like them? Are they similar to me? Do I judge them to be someone who's in my in-group rather than do they have other aspects of them that should make them a more or less trustworthy person?
You do caution against focusing on individual psychology or intelligence, you know, to not blame an individual person for either being, for lack of a better term, mentally ill or dumb. What's the larger focus then here?
Well, so none of us are all that great at doing this thing where we're able to decide what's true based on evidence. That is, as I said, so much work to do. So we really do have to trust those around us. And part of what I think is that if we took a person, say myself, I tend to think I generally have pretty good beliefs, though I'm wrong about lots of things, sure. If I put myself in a bad informational environment where a lot of my friends were saying things that were false or sharing misinformation with me or believe things that were misleading, I think that I would tend to end up with bad beliefs too. So a lot of people in thinking about how do we fight misinformation have thought a lot about fixing issues with our individual psychology, you know, training us to get over our reasoning biases. That is a good thing to do. It's also really important to try to put us in situations where we mostly get good information to begin with.
How good are we at detecting those situations, particularly when we seem to spend a lot of time isolated from physical groups of people and in front of screens where we have online groups of people?
Well, it can be very hard. So, for example, if you are someone who's worried about vaccine safety and you have a group of friends who all are worried about vaccine safety and that's your social environment and that's where you're getting your information, you're going to think we're the right ones and the people who say that vaccines are safe, they're the ones who are wrong and misled, even though, in fact, the scientific evidence, of course, shows that vaccines are safe. So it can be quite hard to know, am I in a good informational environment? Part of what we should want as a society is to try to shape social media environments, science communication environments, so that, in general, most people are getting good information most of the time.
Caitlin O'Connor, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an assistant professor, associate professor of logic and the philosophy of science at the University of California, Irvine, speaking on the misinformation age tonight at 7 at Southern Oregon University's Science Building. Talk about your National Science Foundation grant, Consensus Democracy and the Public Understanding of Science.
Yeah, so Jim Weatherall and I just started this grant. So it's a grant meant to continue with this project, looking at misinformation and the spread of false belief, and especially to think about how this spread of false belief can impair democratic functioning. Because, of course, in order for people in a democracy to make good decisions, we have to have accurate beliefs. So if we have inaccurate beliefs about climate change, we're not going to be able to vote in our own best interest, right? So we know what our values are. We have to have good beliefs to sort of combine with those values to make the decisions that will be best for us.
Is it safe to say there's a trend in human history for technology to come into use before we fully understand the applications and implications?
Maybe what we should say is something like technology often has unexpected consequences that we're bad at predicting. So you're thinking about something like the internet.
Yes, social media, exactly.
Yeah, and social media, which, I mean, there's a huge irony because, so I remember when the internet became a thing. and I want to say people, as I recall, were really excited, thinking like, oh, well, none of us will ever believe anything false again because we can just go online and now we'll have all the knowledge of humanity at our fingertips and look it up. And then, of course, there are these unexpected consequences where, in fact, the social connections that we're making online are creating situations that are just rife for misinformation.
That is the thing that confounds me all the time. The fact is that people will get on Facebook, for example, and say, can you believe this? You know, they share something and next thing you know, 60 of their friends have said, I can't believe this. It just makes me so mad. And yet all of these people on the same piece of equipment, probably in the palms of their hands, that they had access to Facebook, also had access to any one of a number of different sites that could have given them straight facts on the situation they were blowing up about. So we lead with emotion before we get into intellect.
Yeah, right. So we see this all the time. And I'm not going to lie, I've done it too. I've shared memes that turned out to be wrong or news articles that turned out to be wrong. And what's going on is that we trust the people who are sharing them with us. So someone shares this and we think, oh yeah, I trust this person as a source of information. And we assume that person is trustworthy and then we're willing to share it as well. Whereas you point out, it would be so easy just to take 5 seconds and go on whatever Snopes.com to see, is this in fact true?
But this is a key point, it seems like, then, because it comes from people within our social group, even if it's a more expanded social group with social media, we'll trust that information, where perhaps if we'd started with it, we'd saw it on a website that wasn't like all our friends hanging out together. We might have actually checked it out before we went ahead and shared it.
Yeah. So, and actually there's a study, now I can't remember the names of the authors, but they looked at how people decide what to reshare and what information to trust, and found that they're much more sensitive to the source, to the friend who's sharing, rather than to who produced the information. So they look less at, was this, say, the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or some random website, and more at, do I trust the friend who shared it?
Kaylin O'Connor, our guest again on the Jefferson Exchange. She speaks and writes about the misinformation age and will do so tonight at 7 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University. You can join the conversation here on the program at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Looks like Carter in Wolf Creek contacted us first. He wanted to know if recommends the book by Ruth Finnegan called Communicating the Multiple Modes of Human Interconnection. Has it been on your reading list ever?
No, actually, okay. But it sounds pretty good.
Okay, there's a new one. And let's take a call from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi, Jamie.
Well, as long as we're recommending books, I would recommend Future Shock by Alvin Toffler,
mm-hmm.
because that's basically what's happening now. Things are happening so quickly, people don't know whom or what to trust any longer.
The future has arrived.
Yeah. I had a case in point. The Y2K controversy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an electronics engineering technician, so I know a little bit about this. Supposedly, at the end of the millennium, airplanes were supposed to fall down and atomic power plants were going to blow up and things of that nature. There was a worldwide angst, and basically it turned out to be no problem. But a lot of people believed that that was the mm-hmm. case. So it just added to the collective unconsciousness of anxiety. And I just wonder what she had to say about that. I'll take the results off the air.
All right. Thank you, Jamie. Appreciate that.
So I think there's something really relevant here when we're thinking about social media, which is that following the advent of new media at a number of historical times, we've seen problems with misinformation. So in early radio, in early newspaper, we see these issues arising. But then we see society adapting, basically figuring out how to control things. We see government regulations, restrictions on who can have radio stations, things like this. So people figure it out. Now we have social media and we're seeing big problems with misinformation on our social media. One thing that might be an issue, though, is that social media is changing really quickly. So maybe it's changing so quickly that it's going to be hard for us to kind of have time to adapt and control misinformation on these sites before there's the next one, right? So Facebook might be trying to regulate misinformation, but then there's WhatsApp and people are sending, these inflammatory memes on WhatsApp and causing riots. So that might be an issue.
All right. So I was going to ask if that really is about the specific places changing or that we change to the next one down the line. And the answer is the next one down the line. So, if it's not this, it's that, we'll move on to the next thing. We'll use Instagram instead of Facebook. For all the people say, oh, I'd never do Facebook, but they do Instagram too, which, what do you know, is owned by Facebook too, isn't it?
And then there's a related issue which has to do with kind of the flexibility of what you can do on the internet, which is that we see this kind of back and forth, a type of arms race, you might call it, between regulation and misinformation, where, for example, Twitter makes algorithms to detect bots. But once they've done that, the people creating bots make their bots differently so that they can get around the algorithm. So one thing the algorithms were doing was looking at, okay, are these bots retweeting each other? And if you saw a group of, you know, profiles retweeting all the time, you'd think maybe this is a bot network. But then people made new bot networks where instead the bots were commenting and liking each other's posts instead of retweeting. So specifically designed to avoid the algorithm.
You mentioned regulation, which seems to not happen with social media. It is, you know, granted, it doesn't use things like the public airwaves like broadcasters do, like we do. So we have some regulations we have to face. But it seems like there's a great resistance both within the industry itself and of any potential regulators to go ahead and take some regulation in there.
Yeah, I mean, one issue is that the speed of regulation in government is very slow compared to the speed of innovation online.
So the arms race would render the regulation potentially obsolete by the time it gets enacted.
Exactly. So it might be that you try to have some sort of specific regulation and then that doesn't even matter. But I mean, you could think about more general regulation. Of course, there are also big issues having to do with free speech and impingement on free speech rights when it comes to regulating what happens on social media. Now, I don't think that that means that social media platforms shouldn't be regulating to some degree. And I think that a proper understanding of free speech can include some kinds of regulation of really harmful misinformation. But you have to be very careful there, right, to move in a way where you're not impinging on people's constitutional rights.
Let me come back to the National Science Foundation grant that you and Jim Weatherall are working on, which is Consensus, Democracy, and the Public Understanding of Science. I mean, we could certainly make the case that democracy and science have taken a bit of a beating in recent years. Let's talk about the consensus part, though, because and I understand that this is philosophy and not psychology, but do we like having us's and them's? Are we just more comfortable when there's my team and their team?
Well, so from what I've read from psychology, it does seem to be the case that people have almost innate psychologies where it's easy to induce this kind of in-group, out-group feeling. So people do studies where they'll put groups of people into almost random groups. They'll say, like, which of these two paintings do you like better? Okay, now you are the A people and you're the B people. And they find that once they do that, the A people like to treat the A people better, the B people like to treat the B people better, even though they know there's nothing meaningful about those two groups. So it does seem to be that humans are prone to that. I mean, one thing we know is that, for example, Russian misinformation has attempted to increase and set off that kind of psychology in the US. So a big thing that the Russian government has been trying to do with misinformation is to increase polarization, making us into these us and them teams. So it might be that there's some naturalness to how we kind of do that, but also that there are people who have stakes in the game who want to push us apart and divide us into us and them.
So we get revved up a little higher. I noticed that the details in the grant application about the principal investigators have plans to develop an intervention that may serve to improve public uptake of data through social media, to disseminate their results to general audiences, and to develop new programs to mentor graduate and undergraduate students on producing their own public philosophy. Intervention. What do you mean, transmission, reception, or what?
Well, so there are a lot of ways that we can intervene on these kind of informational systems in hopes of making them better. So, for example, some of the interventions that we've talked about and kicked around and that other academics have talked about involve regulating, you know, what types of misinformation we accept on our platforms. You know, are we willing to deplatform certain outrageous misinformation sites or not? So that's one thing, kind of intervention that we've talked about. I mean, there were a number of things that you listed just now that are, you know, kind of different projects and mm-hmm. the grant, but.
Yeah, when I think about intervention, I'm trying to figure out if when you think about this, you think more in terms of the deliverer or the receiver.
So we're thinking more in terms of the deliverer than the receiver, but there's been other really interesting research looking at, you know, how can we intervene to make people better at recognizing misinformation and propaganda online. So there was just a Nature paper that was really fascinating where they had people play a game where they were supposed to be the ones creating online propaganda. Mm-hmm. And in playing that game, they learn about online propaganda techniques and get better at recognizing that. So there's that half of the puzzle. And then we're thinking about intervention really at the platform level. How can we change social media sites to improve the informational environment that all the users are in?
Let me come back to your book and let's talk about some changes in the real world, like not fluoridating water was a big joke, as you point out, in the Dr. Strangelove movie in the early 60s. And now it's really more or less mainstream thought, isn't it?
I don't know if not fluoridating water is mainstream thought.
Well, you've got, you know, city councils and other local governments saying, yeah, we're not going to fluoridate our water.
Right. And you actually have seen that since before Dr. Strangelove. So I live in Orange County, and my water is only partially fluoridated. And that goes back to, what was it, the John Birch Society, which, you know, goes way back. But yeah, right, you see these cases where these scientific beliefs that aren't always accurate are really influencing policy measures in our government.
But so let's talk about another case where the science was it's interesting how that all develops. Though you write about the ozone layer. When scientists said the ozone layer was thinning, what were some of the early responses?
Well, so that is a case where you have not just misinformation, but actual propaganda coming into play. So in their book, Merchants of Doubt, the historians of science, Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway, go through these really relevant cases where what you have are members of industry who know that somehow their product is causing some public health risk, and then go all out spending money, time, and energy to combat public understanding of that science. And the ozone hole was another case like this, where chemical manufacturers were doing what they could to prevent people from really understanding that the ozone was in fact thinning and that it was the result of CFCs being released into the atmosphere.
But it seems like the timeline was relatively compressed here, that from the time that scientists said, hey, we got this problem, we think the ozone layer is thinning, to some actual action, some concrete action to reduce things like the CFCs in the everything from underarm spray to bug spray, the timeline was relatively short.
Yeah, so I would say
over the objections of the chemical industry too.
That seems right. That case is a relative win for science, I would say. So we, you know, regulation managed to follow relatively quickly. It probably was delayed a bit by the actions of industry in that case. When we look at something like global warming, here we have the exact opposite situation, where you have internal memos in Exxon from the 70s making clear that they knew their product was causing global warming and there could be catastrophic health risks. But they've been completely successful in delaying regulation in that case.
So is the evidence not as compelling as it was with ozone, or is the propaganda stronger, or that and social media? I mean, I can imagine it's really hard to pick those apart.
It's hard to get the exact thing. I mean, my sense is that there are a number of things that make these cases different, that the evidence in the CFC's case probably was more compelling. I mean, you could just see a hole in the ozone layer, and there's a very good understanding of the interactions between CFCs and ozone. So maybe the evidence was more compelling, whereas in the climate change case, people are very dependent on these predictive models, which are helpful, of course, but, you know, people are sometimes very mistrustful of modeling methods, and there's a lot of uncertainty in the exact thing that's going to happen predicted by the models. So there's that issue. But also, you know, cars and the use of fossil fuels is just a completely central part of our society compared to the use of CFCs. We could replace CFCs relatively easily, whereas replacing oil and gas is a huge lift.
You can change your hair hole to a pump spray easily, but,
right.
but not so much replacing your car. With the many examples through history that you've explored, though, I mean, have you ever seen such polarization on science, or at least in the application of science?
Well, let me think about this. I mean, there are so many cases in the history of science of weird misinformation and scientists being in different groups where they really disagree about things. It's hard for me to say if there are other cases where it's like so widespread and it's become so politically enmeshed as something like climate change, and really everyone's got an opinion and it's super polarized. But you can see these cases of polarization, say, within scientific communities. So we give this case in the book of you might almost call like early anti-vaccine, where in the 1700s, this British noblewoman was trying to bring the practice of variolation for smallpox to England. And you saw a bunch of physicians getting really up in arms, being like, no, don't trust this woman. We shouldn't use this practice. Everyone was debating it in the newspapers. And so people were kind of aware about this debate happening. So we have seen some similar cases, maybe.
With climate change in particular, I wrote down the term, it's so good, politically enmeshed. I mean, is it the key to club membership? I mean, you know, if you believe that humans caused it, you're in the club or, you know, or out.
Well, what you see sometimes with these kind of polarized beliefs is that they become signals of group membership. So I think that's kind of what you're getting at here, that your belief, it's not only just what you believe, but it also tells other people who you are, what you're about. It tells them, are you progressive? Are you conservative? Are you the kind of person that might be friends with this other person? So our beliefs end up playing this other social role that can have funny effects on how they spread. So we discuss in the book a paper that we did where we looked at a computer simulation where people were, you know, sharing evidence and beliefs with each other. And we asked, well, what happens if we make all these people want to conform with each other, where they always want to be saying the same thing as those around them? And when we do that, they get worse at sharing beliefs because you get these clumps of people who are all going to say, oh, none of us believe in climate change, and then they're insensitive to evidence that would be good evidence.
So, you know, I've focused mostly on how the world at large responds to science news here, but is the polarization of the world and the ability to gain acceptance of half and non-truths affecting the actual production of science? I mean, is it affecting the work of scientists and, for that matter, philosophers of science?
So certainly public belief ends up feeding back into what scientists do. So, for example, climate scientists are very aware of how much rests on their research, how much is at stake when they create this research, right? How people are going to respond to it, how people are going to challenge it. And so that knowledge that their work is in the public eye is going to be influencing in some ways, you know, the way they do things and certainly the way they communicate it.
Okay, we talked a little bit about the ozone hole and the quick move there, the rather slow moves on climate change. But then there's the story of the acid rain peer review panel in the 80s. Tell that story.
Oh, okay. I don't want to spread fake news by getting turned around about the details because my co-author wrote up this case.
But essentially, it was one person who was on a panel able to hold up the work of the panel and therefore hold up regulation.
Yeah, so it was becoming increasingly clear that coal burning was causing acid rain. So some of the emissions from coal plants would mix with rain in the atmosphere and then acidify certain lakes and cause problems for fish and plant life, et cetera. And this also was causing international problems because, for example, U.S. coal production was causing acid rain in Canada. So the government put together a panel where they were going to give advice to Congress about this. And every member of the panel agreed that acid rain was causing this problem. They were going to advise regulation. One member of the panel was a representative of, you know, coal and basically worked very hard to hold this all up and managed to sort of add an extra chapter that went against what everyone else was saying to the document they presented and as a result stopped regulation for, I can't remember exactly how long, but several years.
Well, it essentially, the acid rain peer review panel was created during the Reagan administration and any regulation was created after Reagan left office.
That's right.
Because it was about 5-year holdup there. So one person can really essentially blockade the door and make sure that things don't get done.
It's sort of remarkable what kind of effect in that case just one person could have on regulation of these environmental issues.
You know, one of the amazing things about your work is how you direct our attention to not just how we think we know things, but also how the information gets disseminated in the first place. You know, how discoveries are made, for example. You know, it's often been remarked upon about the fact that, you know, if this guy hadn't invented the telephone, actually somebody put a patent in, I guess, the same day as Alexander Graham Bell.
Oh, is that right?
I think that is the story. Huh. Now I may be spreading fake news. I'm going to check this out before the end of the show. But the fact that information is shared, information does permeate, it does move around, even in times of low technical ability to move communications around. So you get situations where discoveries seem to be made almost simultaneously in different parts of the world.
That has happened quite a few times in the history of science. And you might think of it as something like a bunch of precursor discoveries had been made that would set people up to do the next thing, and then there's some increased chance that multiple people can kind of figure out the same thing around the same time.
I'm still looking up the who's credited with inventing the telephone. Okay. Elisha Gray, I think.
Well, Darwin and Wallace is an
famous
example.
So can you give some guidance? I mean, we can either stay up all night researching endlessly or shut off the computers and hide under the bed, avoiding social media in particular. I imagine there is some middle ground here.
Yeah. So, I mean, as an individual, you, of course, can do things to improve your information literacy. You can, you know, go do this video game where you act as a propagandist to try to understand propaganda techniques. You can read about things. Now, I think that as, you know, members of the public, we should be putting pressure on social media platforms and on our government to regulate some of the misinformation on there. Because, you know, regulation, it's to improve public health and prevent public harm. And in some cases, the kind of misinformation we're seeing is causing really serious public harm. And if we look at our history of regulation, we've been willing sometimes to regulate that kind of thing. So, for example, you can't make a cigarette ad and market it towards children because the public harm is so great in that case. So we should.
For that matter, you can't advertise cigarettes in broadcasting at all. I haven't been able to for a very long time.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so first you couldn't do it to children. Now you can't do it in general in many on many media platforms. We should be demanding of our platforms, like, we want, you know, flags when something comes from a completely fake news site. We want, you know, bots to be kicked off Twitter as much as they can. Twitter's trying, but it's hard, right? We can say to our government, you know, we want to be in good informational environments where we can trust that the people around us aren't Russians misleading us or members of some political party who are creating propaganda to mislead us.
That arms race you mentioned earlier, does it get into things like the ability of bots to get more sophisticated to avoid detection as bots?
Yes. So bots are one example. But just in general, you see all these cases where even as the public becomes savvy to some misinformation technique, that one disappears and a new one arises. So if you'll remember in 2016, fake news was the big thing. And they were articles that looked like a normal news article. And then someone would share that, you click and read it, but it'd be fake news. When's the last time you've seen a fake news article like that on social media? Well, they're not really going around anymore because people figured that one out. But instead, you're seeing misleading memes, you're seeing misleading videos. So people are worried now about the rise of deepfake videos photographs. So the next thing kind of keeps coming.
All right. Finally, let me ask you, Kaylin O'Connor, the meaning of an Erdos Bacon number and why yours is 7.
Yeah, okay. The Ardosh Bacon number. So Paul Ardosh was this mathematician who very famously collaborated with many, many people. And I've heard that he would go and like sleep on someone's couch and write a paper with him. So if you collaborated with Ardosh, your Ardosh number is 1. And if you collaborate with someone who collaborated with Ardosh, your Ardosh number is 2 and so on. Your Bacon number is if you were in a movie with Kevin Bacon, your Bacon number is 1 and then 2, et cetera. So there are a handful of people who have Ardosh Bacon numbers. So Natalie Portman, for example, has one. So I was in a movie in college that went on the festival circuit, and one of the actresses with me went on to be a successful actress, and so, sorry, actor. And so I have a Bacon number and an Ardosh number.
Okay, that is impressive. Okay, I heard about the degrees of separation of Kevin Bacon, but I didn't realize it got to the point of having a separation number. So congratulations on having an Ardosh.
I guess that you can have an Ardosh Bacon Sabbath number too if you've.
Oh, I've noticed that.
A show with Black Sabbath, but I'm not a musician, so
okay.
Sadly. Not.
That explains that too. Thank you so much. So thank you for clearing up the things that I might have gone off half-cocked about. The Misinformation Age is a book and the talk by Kaylin O'Connor tonight at 7 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University, room 151, as part of this year's science theme, Uncertainty. Thanks to Prakash Chengeri for bringing Kaylin O'Connor to us. And Kaylin, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.